as well as the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. He has also appeared on Liberty Weekly, Around the Empire, and Parallax Views. And you can follow him on Twitter at Freeman's Mind 96. So here's Connor.
Thank you very much, everybody. I'd like to first thank the great Dennis and Carol Pratt for putting this on for everybody, and thank you all for coming out. So I'm going to talk about the new Cold War with China today. The ruling class in America is planning on using America's sons and daughters as cannon fodder to wage their long-awaited war against China. President Joe Biden, along with the other de facto employees of the military-industrial complex, including in Congress, as well as the key leadership, have not made their plans a secret, as you'll see. Contrarily, they are quite happy to brag about basically any escalation they can get. Hawks in the Pentagon, along with those in the legislative branch, including the key leadership, have been speaking explicitly about the coming war with China for a while now, usually boasting about all they're doing to prepare for, as well as to provoke such a conflict. Thank you. This all began in earnest during the Barack Obama administration. In 2011, Obama launched the Pivot to Asia. The policy has been expanded by each successive administration. Despite the Republican Party's long-held obsession with the Chinese Communist Party, this project was always led by the progressive Democrats, namely Obama, Biden, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Michelle Flournoy, and the top Asia official on Biden's National Security Council, Kirk Campbell. Obama's project for the new American century entails the largest military buildup since the Second World War, shifting two-thirds of all American air and naval forces to the Asia-Pacific region, as well as hundreds of military bases, encircling China for a future war. In the words of Lou Rockwell, the founder of the Mises Institute, the U.S. seeks to encircle China and make it bow down before the hegemon. That was written more than a decade ago. The American people must catch up. The new Cold War on China has been heating up for years, but things have taken a turn for the worse under the Biden regime, which, despite what you may have heard, is significantly more hawkish than both the Obama and the Trump administrations. In January of this year, the top U.S. Marine Corps general in Japan explained to the Financial Times that Washington and Tokyo are setting the theater for war with China. Lieutenant General James Bierman, commander of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force and Marine Forces Japan, said that Washington is working with its allies in the region to prepare for the coming war with China, much like the U.S. did with its NATO allies after the U.S.-backed coup in Kiev in 2014. He said, "Why have we achieved the level of success we've achieved in Ukraine? A big part of that has been because after Russian aggression in 2014 and 2015, we earnestly got after preparing for a future conflict. Training the Ukrainians, prepositioning of supplies, identification of sites from which we could operate support and sustain operations." He went on to explain this is called setting the theater, and we are setting the theater in Japan and in the Philippines and in other locations, he declared. Later that same month, NBC News reported on a memo written by 4-star U.S. Air Force General Mike Minahan, the head of Air Mobility Command, discussing the coming war with China. Air Mobility Command includes 50,000 airmen and roughly 430 aircraft. He said, "I hope I am wrong. My gut tells me we will fight in 2025. Minahan said this as he was ordering his officers to begin preparing for war with China. In recent weeks and months, the U.S. has worked on deals to gain exclusive military access to Papua New Guinea, the Federated States of Micronesia, secured an agreement with Manila to gain access to 4 more military bases in the Philippines, including some provocatively close to Taiwan, preparing for this war. They've awarded contracts to begin work on a new radar installation in Palau. They've announced increased cooperation between American and Japanese forces for a future confrontation with China, and made plans to deploy additional Marine units armed with anti-ship missiles along the Okinawa Islands. In April, Washington and Manila carried out their largest ever joint military exercises. 17,600 military personnel, including 12,000 American troops, participated. There were also 100 Australian soldiers present and joining the exercises. The increasing pressure on both China and Russia in this region has seen Moscow and Beijing step up their own cooperation and war games in the region. Not nearly as much, but there is definitely a reaction. and we could be seeing a massive conflict here in the near future. And later this year, the U.S. and Australia will carry out the largest ever iteration of their Talisman Sabre war drills. The bilateral military exercise takes place every 2 years. As Antiwar.com news editor Dave DeCamp explained, the plans for the massive exercises come after the U.S., Australia, and Britain unveiled their plans under the AUKUS military pact with the ultimate goal of Australia being able to produce their own nuclear-powered submarines by the 2040s. The U.S. Navy envisions AUKUS, Australia, UK, U.S., will turn Australia into a full-service submarine hub for the United States and its allies in the region during the coming war with China. As a part of the deepening U.S.-Australian military ties, the United States also plans to deploy more troops and aircraft to Australia, including nuclear-capable B-52 bombers. As Professor Noam Chomsky recently warned, one U.S. submarine can destroy almost 200 cities anywhere in the world with its nuclear weapons. The United States is sending a fleet of nuclear submarines to Australia. That's the AUKUS deal. The right measure is not increasing provocation, increasing the threat of an accidental development, which could lead to devastating, even virtually terminal nuclear war. But that's the direction the Biden administration is following. The rhetoric of U.S. military leaders may seem unhinged, given that I'm presenting it in this way altogether. But it's not all, it's all too common. You see, in February, U.S. Army Secretary Christine Wormuth declared that we need to be prepared to fight a direct, hot war against China over Taiwan, the island of Taiwan, and win it. She said, "I am personally not of the view that an amphibious invasion of Taiwan is imminent." She said this to an audience at the neoconservative American Enterprise Institute think tank. She added, "But we obviously have to be prepared to fight and win this war." Her plan consists of sending more U.S. troops and advanced weapons to the region, including hypersonic missiles. She also discussed setting up theater distribution centers in the region where weapons and other supplies can be pre-positioned for the coming war, suggesting that Japan and Australia would make great candidates for this. She said, "Our goal is to have Army forces in the Indo-Pacific 7 to 8 months out of the year. When the war starts, their job will be establishing staging bases for the Navy, for the Marines, for the Air Force," adding they will be providing intra-theater sustainment. Now, I know this crowd will like this next part. Wormuth also discussed what appeared to be a plan for the Army to impose martial law in the United States during the coming war with China. She said, "If we got into a major war with China, the United States homeland would be at risk as well, with both kinetic attacks and non-kinetic attacks. Whether it's cyber attacks on power grids or on pipelines, the United States Army, I have no doubt, will be called to provide defense support to civil authorities." Let's talk a bit about Taiwan and the death of strategic ambiguity. This is the heart of the matter. In March, General Kenneth Wilspach, the head of U.S. Pacific Air Forces, told a symposium in Colorado that his focus is on blowing up Chinese ships in the event that Beijing orders a blockade on the island of Taiwan. He said, "You saw when Speaker Pelosi went to Taiwan, what China did with their ships," Wilspach said, adding, "They put them on the east side of Taiwan as a sort of blockade. The general's conclusion is we've got to sink those ships." He continued, "Sinking ships is a main objective of not only Pacific Air Forces, but really anyone that's going to be involved in a conflict like this. In other words, even if the cross-strait conflict, which Washington's build up and increased ties with Taiwan is actively provoking and cultivating, does not immediately go kinetic, men like General Wilspach will ensure that it goes kinetic as soon as possible as a result of their attempts to shoot through this Chinese naval blockade." That same month, you may hear that we have to defend Taiwan, we have to get rid of strategic ambiguity because of how important semiconductors and chips are to the world economy, and that it's a national security issue. Chips, chips, you'll hear this all the time. Well, that same month, Trump's former national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, said in the event of a cross-strait conflict between China and the island of Taiwan, the U.S. would bomb and destroy Taiwan's advanced semiconductor manufacturing facilities. He said the United States and its allies are never going to let those factories fall into Chinese hands. O'Brien threatened this during an interview with Semaphore earlier this year. Now, a similar plan was laid out in a 2021 paper drawn up by the U.S. Army War College. The paper characterizes obliterating Taiwan's chip factories as a scorched earth strategy designed to leave Taiwan in ruins, not just unattractive if ever seized by force, but positively costly to maintain. They said this could be a joint operation with Taiwan, even. The paper continues, explaining this could be done most effectively by threatening to destroy facilities belonging to the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, the most important chip maker in the world and China's most important supplier. Again, that same month, Representative Seth Malton, a Democrat just over the border in Massachusetts, told a think tank conference, the U.S. should make it very clear to the Chinese that if you invade Taiwan, we're going to blow up the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which produces most of the world's advanced semiconductors. Now, apparently, the Taiwanese military did not get this memo. Taiwan's defense minister, Chi Ko-cheng, fired back at the congressman, saying, it is the military's obligation to defend Taiwan. We will not tolerate any others blowing up our facilities. In April, for the first time, the U.S. Army's Special Operations Command defended Taiwan from a mock Chinese invasion as part of CAPEX, the command's annual capabilities exercise. Lieutenant General Jonathan P. Braga declared, it's about time. These war drills are in accordance with our national defense strategy. China is our true pacing challenge out there. Now, this is important. So Obama declared the Asia pivot in 2011, as we just discussed. This was codified in our national defense strategy in 2018, written by Elbridge Colby, the grandfather of CIA Director William Colby, and under Defense Secretary General James Mattis, outlined a shift from our focus on so-called counterterrorism in North Africa and the Middle East, pivoting toward great power competition with Russia and China. China, it's been reaffirmed again under Biden in the new national defense strategy, is enemy number one. Russia is seconded. Russia has to be destroyed and weakened before the U.S. takes on China in a direct war. Lieutenant General Jonathan P. Braga declared, according to military.com, members of the U.S. Army Special Operations Command in these drills fired Carl Gustav recoilless rifles, breached tunnels, and operated switchblade drones that flew with an unsettling whiz over a training area. The exercise combined some of the hallmark tactics and weapons that were used during the global war on terror, with other tools reflecting a seismic shift for the command as it prepares for potential conflict against major military rivals. And the mission they were gaming out was an insertion into Taiwan to defend against a Chinese invasion. Last fall, Navy Admiral Charles Richard, the head of Strategic Command, which oversees America's nuclear forces, ominously warned, the Ukraine crisis we're in right now, this is just a warm-up. The big one is coming, and it isn't going to be very long before we're challenged in ways we haven't been challenged in a long time. Unmistakably, the big one is the coming war with China. Now, for almost 50 years, the One China policy has governed our now extremely fragile relationship between Washington and Beijing. 30 years after Mao's forces won the Civil War and Chiang Kai-shek's forces fled to Formosa and conquered the indigenous population, Washington accepted reality and made an agreement which has kept peace and prevented war. Under the policy, the U.S. severed diplomatic ties with Taipei and recognized that there is but one China, with Beijing as the sole Chinese government. One China means the U.S. does not have an official relationship with Taipei, with Washington recognizing China and Taiwan as the same country. The U.S. also maintains strategic ambiguity towards Taiwan, or at least it did, until the Joe Biden administration unilaterally overturned that part of the delicate policy. Per the former approach, the U.S. would never commit to defending nor not defending the island against a potential attack against the breakaway province if Beijing launched it. Now, critically, strategic ambiguity and what's also internally referred to as dual deterrence has aimed to deter Beijing from attempting to retake the island by force, but also to discourage Taiwan's radical factions who may seek to declare independence. Now, but for the bipartisan China hawks, this successful arrangement is no longer good enough. Worst of all, some are proposing, and in some cases outright issuing, defense commitments in contradiction of longstanding U.S. policy. You may have heard of President Joe Biden. Since Biden came into office, he has continued to make gaffes, announcing the U.S. is doing away with strategic ambiguity, and even potentially the One China policy. Biden has repeatedly committed at CNN town halls, 60 Minutes, committed America's sons and daughters to the defense of the island of Taiwan in the event of a Chinese attack. But now it appears that these notorious mistakes, which were often walked back by the White House, were not gaffes at all. In March, speaking before a House Intelligence Committee hearing, Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines announced that strategic ambiguity was dead and gone. When asked by Representative Chris Stewart, Republican out of Utah, if maybe we ought to just do away with strategic ambiguity. What do you say, Director? Haines responded by announcing, I think it's clear to the Chinese what our position is based on the President's comments. Indeed, Washington constantly ramps up our military cooperation with Taipei. We're committing billions of dollars, unprecedentedly, in military aid to the island. We're expanding U.S. National Guard training programs with the Taiwanese military. We're sending ever more congressional delegations to the island, stepping all over the One China policy. We now have reportedly 200 U.S. troops on the island training their forces for war with the mainland. We're concurrently training hundreds of Taiwanese soldiers for war with China here on U.S. soil. We also, you can read in the New York Times about how we're planning on converting the island of Taiwan into a giant weapons depot. That's the name of the article. Just Google it. We're going to pour so many weapons into the island that if China instigate, if they launch this blockade, then we can still have our proxy war. And we sail American warships through the sensitive Strait of Taiwan. This is the distance of 80 miles between China and Taiwan. We sail warships through there every month. The U.S. government absurdly promises that these provocations are done merely to deter war. But China's made it clear that Taiwan is a red line, and U.S. actions make war more likely. Beijing has repeatedly said that they seek a peaceful reunification with the province. But that Taiwan is not ruled, I mean, excuse me, China has not ruled out using force. So all of our actions are essentially maneuvering them into firing the first shot here. Now, even Haines appeared to admit this when at the same hearing she said, it's not our assessment that China wants to go to war. Bellicose members of Congress are foaming at the mouth for a confrontation with China nonetheless. The commander of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral John Aquilino, highlighted the military's threatening posture towards China last month, speaking at the annual meeting of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. The group is known for encouraging engagement between the world's two largest economies, which is sorely needed in order to avoid this war, and yet another confirmation that the White House has overturned the longstanding strategic ambiguity policy. Aquilino went so far as to say that President Biden and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin have tasked him to prepare to fight and win this war over Taiwan against China. He said, what I can tell you is the Secretary and the President have tasked me with two missions. The first is to prevent this conflict, and then the second one is if I fail at mission one, to be prepared to fight and win. The United States military is manned, trained, equipped, postured, and ready to execute both of those missions, the Indo-PACCOM chief said. And why we have hired a man in charge of the most important military policy in the world potentially right now, where he's expecting failure, and then if I fail, well, I'll launch this a war that will go nuclear at a rapid pace. It would just be completely out of control. And that's this man, if you watch this speech, you will be terrified by his incompetence, his arrogance, and his ignorance, and the fact that he really doesn't care if he does succeed with job one. He's most focused on job two. And they're bellicose, and they just want to continue on this current path we're on. So he said, now let's talk about warplanes and spy planes in the South China Sea. During the last few years, the U.S. has vastly increased the presence of warships and spy planes in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and the Yellow Sea, including near China's coast. In 2020, while Americans were distracted by the COVID-19 crisis, Trump's war cabinet seized the opportunity to dramatically expand America's military footprint in this region. U.S. warships and even aircraft carrier strike groups were reported constantly sailing in the South China Sea. In July 2020, the South China Sea Strategic Situation Probing Initiative, a Beijing-based think tank, reported that the U.S. flew record numbers of aerial surveillance flights in the South China Sea and near China's coast. The numbers of reconnaissance flights at that time averaged 3 to 5 per day. So just imagine if you put the shoe on the other foot and Chinese spy planes and warships were this close to the Atlantic, to our Atlantic coast, to our Pacific coast, or in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, that same month, the Trump administration formally rejected all of China's claims to waters in the South China Sea. The policy has since been reaffirmed by the Biden regime. Under both administrations, the U.S. has been challenging China using the Navy's 7th Fleet, inserting itself in disputes between various regional actors there whom all have overlapping claims on the waters, including over various unmanned rocks, reefs, islands, islets, and archipelagos. Even if it means war with China, we are committed to go to war with China in order to defend Japan's claims to the disputed and unmanned Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. The Senkakus are claimed not only by Beijing and Tokyo, but also by Taipei. What a predicament. Washington has promised the U.S. military will come to the Philippines' defense in the event of a violent conflict with China as well in the South China Sea, potentially over the disputed Whitsun Reef. The Whitsun Reef, the site of recent tensions in the last couple of years, is claimed not only by China and the Philippines, but by Vietnam as well. Now, the Navy routinely conducts what it calls freedom of navigation operations in the waters surrounding China, sailing warships through these waters, particularly in the South China Sea, usually provocatively close to these Chinese or claimed islands. In September of 2020, record numbers of American warplanes and spy planes near China's coast were spotted and recorded. There were at least 60 flights, including over the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and the Yellow Sea. The U.S. was sending refueling aircraft from Guam to replenish the spy planes, enabling them to continue their operations. As Dave DeCamp, our news editor at antiwar.com, wrote at the time, that these sorties are interpreted as the U.S. potentially preparing for long-range attacks on targets in the South China Sea. Upon entering the Oval Office, the writing on the wall was clear that President Biden would be vastly more hawkish on China than Donald Trump ever was. In February of 2021, 75 U.S. reconnaissance aircraft flights in the South China Sea were documented. Biden said bluntly the U.S. is in extreme competition with China, that we're going to unite the whole country into defeating China and winning the 21st century, winning the competition. But as you can see, it's this, the military component overwhelms everything. It's not economic cooperation, it's competition on every front. Biden said we're competing to win the 21st century, and Space Force announced plans for the moon to be a militarized front. They see it as a good future venue for a war. Washington is spending more on the military and so-called defense than at any time in our nation's history under President Biden. The Republican Party's neocons say that even Biden's national security budget request for $886 billion is inadequate, not enough. We have to prepare for, we have to spend more to get ready for this war with China. The Pentagon's excuse for its record high spending is always Beijing, the so-called pacing threat. This is what you'll see in the National Defense Strategy. You see, for instance, Frank Kendall, our current Secretary of the Air Force, who was formerly a vice president at Raytheon. Of course, Lloyd Austin walked off Raytheon's board of directors and became our Pentagon chief. Kendall said he has three priorities: China, China, and China. And he said that we really need to invest and spend money on weaponry, military weaponry, that will scare the hell out of China. Hopefully Raytheon can get some of those contracts. Now, some of our hawks will be refreshingly honest. You know, China, they'll say that China does, well, they wouldn't put it this way, but it poses a threat to Washington's imperial domination. At least, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said in April of 2021, America has held unchallenged global military, political, and economic power. With the rise of China, that is changing and changing fast. Excuse me, when I said April of 21, I meant to say this. The Chinese Defense Ministry declared that since Biden had taken office in January, the volatile situation in the region had already considerably worsened. As the South China Morning Post reported on that day that Biden targeted Beijing in his first speech to Congress, his first speech to the joint session of Congress, that they said that Wei Qian, the Chinese Defense Ministry spokesman, said operations had increased by more than 20% with American warships and by more than 40% with American warplanes, compared to the same time period under the previous year when Trump was in office. Now, as Patrick McFarlane, writer and podcaster, and our Justin Raimondo fellow at the Libertarian Institute wrote at the time, in February of 2021, a U.S. reconnaissance plane actually flirted with the same airspace as a sortie of Chinese warplanes. On May 14, 2021, the U.S. Navy announced the deployment of four MQ-4C Triton drones from Guam to northern Japan, the first such deployment of high-altitude, long-endurance unmanned aerial vehicles to Japan. Now, these are used to spy on the Taiwan Strait, the Chinese People's Liberation Army, their bases on the coast, and military installations in the South China Sea. In March of 2021, a U.S. Air Force RC-135U flew within 25.33 nautical miles of the Chinese coast, closer than any U.S. military plane recorded yet. In April, an American destroyer conducted close surveillance of a Chinese aircraft carrier called the Liaoning as it was taking part in exercises in the South China Sea. The U.S. often deploys military aircraft to shadow these drills as well. The U.S. Navy at that time released a photo of officers on the deck of a guided missile destroyer, the USS Mustin, staring down the Lioning. Also in April, satellite imagery revealed that another U.S. guided missile destroyer actually entered into the Lioning strike group and sailed with it for a time. The aircraft carrier was returning from a deployment in the South China Sea to the East China Sea. Now, as Dave DeCampus explained, that considering such reconnaissance can be accomplished with the use of satellites, the goal of these hyper-aggressive maneuvers is solely to ramp up tensions. In July of 2021, reports indicated that the Navy had been quite busy that year, deploying an almost non-stop, non-stop deployments of naval surveillance vessels in the South China Sea. U.S. Navy ocean surveillance vessels were operating in the South China Sea for 161 days out of the first 181 days of 2021. The U.S. has five of those vessels stationed in Japan, which are typically active in the South China Sea for more than 10 days at a time, and there is virtually no time between these deployments. Now, the report also said that the primary purpose of these deployments is to monitor the dynamics of China's underwater forces and analyze the scope of submarine activities, their entry and exit points, and to provide intelligence support for these anti-submarine operations. In his aforementioned first congressional address, Biden boasted that he told President Xi that, quote, we will maintain a strong military presence in the Indo-Pacific just as we do with NATO in Europe. And we all saw that worked out. And thus, Washington's allies are getting in on the Asia pivot as well. Under Biden's leadership, we had the British sail their new aircraft carrier, the HMS Queen Elizabeth, into the South China Sea in 2021. Its strike group included an American destroyer and warplanes as well. London will soon permanently deploy two warships to Asia. This was declared in a joint statement with the Japanese. Now, Japan is a part of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, otherwise known as the Quad, with the US, Australia, and India. And the Hawks hope to make the Quad into an East Asian version of NATO. Financial Times was told by a source in 2021 that they were, who was familiar with the strategy, that the Biden administration is making the Quad the core dynamic of its Asia policy. In 2020, in an unmistakable message to the Chinese, the Quad's navies held war drills in the Bay of Bengal, the largest such exercises that they'd carried out in more than a decade. Now, Tokyo has been hyping up the threat to Taiwan posed by China as well. Former Japanese Deputy Prime Minister Taro Aso, in July of 2021, said in a major incident over the island, Japan and the U.S. must defend Taiwan together. With more than 50,000 troops, Japan hosts the largest overseas U.S. military presence. During his first year in office, Biden nearly doubled the deployment of U.S. aircraft carrier strike groups to the South China Sea. There were 10 deployments that year. By November 2021, Biden's military flew more than 2,000 sorties of spy planes, again in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and the Yellow Sea. Washington's Western allies have also been performing these same sort of provocative operations, not nearly to the same extent, but we saw German, French, British, and Canadian warships traversing these same waters in China's backyard. Last year, NATO, the offensive alliance, targeted China in its new strategic concept document. Beijing has recently responded by taking actions to deter these naval patrols, including in the Taiwan Strait and U.S. flights in the region. So Stephen Orlins, the Indo-Pacific Command, the chief of Indo-PACCOM, Aquilino, I just mentioned, his interlocutor at that meeting, the annual meeting of the Committee on U.S.-China Relations, the National Committee, his interlocutor was Stephen Orlins, who asked some very basic common sense questions. He's chairman of the group. He said, you say we have more dangerous intercepts by the Chinese. Well, the Chinese say there's a simple answer to that. Run fewer surveillance flights. You know, then there'll be fewer dangerous intercepts. Given the capability of our satellites, do we need to run as many surveillance flights as we do? And can you give us a sense as to how many are actually run these days? And he sort of scoffed at that and pretended that these numbers can't be found in the public record. But he said, you know, I can't tell you that. But his answer was, refused to entertain any culpability on the American side for these tensions. He said, I understand the argument that says if you would just leave, we would be happy. That's an interesting argument. That said, that's not going to happen. Aquilino blamed Chinese dangerous and escalatory actions against the U.S. for the situation, but Washington's substantial military interventions in the region are making conflicts and accidents more likely, exponentially more likely. According to this South China Sea Strategic Situation Probing Initiative, in last year, there were 1,000 sorties of large American reconnaissance aircraft. There were 8 deployments of aircraft carrier strike groups and amphibious alert groups, and at least 12 by nuclear-powered attack submarines. Now, we'll just say something about diplomacy and the recent breakdown in communication. Aquilino censored China over the breakdown in communication between the two militaries. Again, Orleans asked the Minister of National Defense is sanctioned by the U.S. government. Can our military take a position on whether that's a good policy to sanction the defense minister of China? In other words, if he's sanctioned, it's highly unlikely he's going to answer the phone. Now, Biden's refusal to lift the sanctions on the Chinese defense minister was cited as a reason for the fact that there was no meeting held between the two military chiefs earlier this month at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. And having none of it, the admiral simply warned, we're postured in the appropriate places. The United States does not choose to escalate. We're not being provocative, but I'm confident we'd be able to fight and win wherever it went. He continued, asserting there's no one-trick pony that we utilize to both deter and then if we were to unfortunately get into any kind of a conflict. For the United States, it's the synchronization of integrated efforts of the entire joint force, on the sea, under the sea, above the sea, in space, and in cyberspace. So if anyone was to choose to take on the United States, they're going to get the full Monty. In May 2021, Biden's top Asia official, Kurt Campbell, head of Indo-Pacific Affairs on the National Security Council, was speaking at an event hosted by Stanford University, where he declared that our previous era of engagement with China is over. Campbell is known as the architect of this Asia pivot. He said that period that was broadly described as engagement has come to an end. The dominant paradigm is now going to be competition. For the first time, really, we are shifting our strategic focus, our economic interests, and our military might to the Indo-Pacific. Now, in 2016, on 12 separate occasions, Barack Obama had his military and his Navy sail warships through the Taiwan Strait, so about once every month. In 2020, Trump beat Obama's record by doing it 13 times. By the time Biden had been in office for just over 6 months, American warships had sailed the Taiwan Strait 7 times. Carlos Del Toro, Biden's Secretary of the Navy, vowed to the Senate Armed Services Committee during his confirmation process that he would exclusively focus on China, moving our maritime strategy forward in order to protect Taiwan and all our national security interests in the Indo-Pacific theater. Again, another indication that strategic ambiguity is dead. At the time, Republican Senator Josh Hawley asked Del Toro, is it vital for the U.S. to be able to prevent an attack on Taiwan by China? The nominee ominously responded, absolutely. In the worst case scenario, this policy could kill millions of people or more. This fact apparently does not mean as much to Del Toro and men like these other military commanders as much as their petty career advancement. As senior fellow at Defense Priorities, the Afghan War whistleblower, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis has explained, it is crucial to understand that for China, the Taiwan issue is not merely a core interest, but an emotionally charged one. They are far more willing to pay extraordinary costs, sacrifice many men, and could risk it all to eventually compel unification with Taiwan. The issue does not directly affect our national security unless we get involved. If we eventually choose war with China over Taiwan, we will at best suffer egregious losses in ships, aircraft, and troops, and in the worst case, the war could deteriorate into a nuclear exchange in which American cities are turned into nuclear wastelands, killing millions. America should never take such risks unless our security and freedom are directly threatened. Fighting China for any reason short of that would be a foolish gamble of the highest order. Now, although designed and overseen by liberal hawks such as Campbell and led officially by Democrats like Biden and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, the Asia pivot as well as its ancillary exploitation of the Taiwan issue as a means of goading China has its roots in infamous neoconservative circles. That is, namely, the now-defunct Project for a New American Century think tank, founded by Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan. For instance, PNAC's notorious September 2000 document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, contains an outline of the Asia pivot, where they say raising U.S. military strength in East Asia is the key to coping with the rise of China to great power status. Reflecting the gradual shift in the focus of American strategic concerns toward East Asia, a majority of the U.S. fleet, including 2/3 of all carrier battle groups, should be concentrated in the Pacific. A new permanent forward base should be established in Southeast Asia, and that's exactly what we're doing. These are the same neocons who led the push for war in Iraq, in which maybe more than 1 million Iraqis were killed. In April, During an interview on Fox News Sunday, Republican senator and neoconservative spokesman Lindsey Graham called for an outright reversal of strategic ambiguity, as well as a complete overhaul of Washington's China policy. As the Libertarian Institute's Kyle Anzalone reported, Graham claimed the United States had only a short window of time to prepare for the coming conflict, calling to, quote, increase training and get the F-16s they need in Taiwan. He also complained about a backlog of arms sales to the island, arguing the transfer should move ahead while proposing new U.S. military deployments in Asia and elsewhere. He said, I would move war forces to South Korea and to Japan, and I would put nuclear-tipped cruise missiles on all of our submarines all over the world, Graham continued. He additionally explained he was willing to send U.S. troops to fight and die for Taipei, a dramatic departure from longstanding policy, saying, yes, I'd be very much open to using U.S. forces to defend Taiwan. The ultra-hawkish Republican chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Representative Michael McCaul from Texas, the Republican, further declared that sending U.S. troops to fight China over the island of Taiwan is on the table. McCaul clarified his position that if Communist China invaded Taiwan, it would certainly be on the table, and that's something that would be discussed by Congress and with the American people. How gracious of our ostensible representatives that after more than 70 years of illegal, undeclared wars, killing millions, that they're saying that, you know, if we do decide to go to war with China, another nuclear superpower, we may at least have some kind of a conversation with the American people. But to date, we the people have never been consulted about these policies. The hyperdrive propaganda against China is already designedly overwhelming our neighbors' psyches. Given the current anti-Russia hysteria among the populace, with minimal domestic resistance, the White House has been able to ratchet tensions with Moscow to levels higher than since the Cuban Missile Crisis via its proxy war in Ukraine. Actually, it's worse than that. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists say that the risks of nuclear war have never been higher. There is no telling what Americans may be frightened into if a cross-strait conflict kicks off, or if there is an accident or confrontation between U.S. and Chinese forces in the South China Sea. Not too long ago, some were almost calling for war with China over a solitary meteorological balloon. As is the case with Russia, the U.S. launching a direct war with Beijing is essentially guaranteed to lead to a nuclear exchange. In such a scenario, China has the ability to destroy continental American cities, not just the aircraft carrier strike groups and hundreds of bases encircling China. This should go without saying, but if the hawks were honest about the risks of war with China that they are proposing and cultivating, the American people would refuse to allow a continuation of this buildup at all. It's not inconceivable that under these circumstances, an informed American populace may collectively decide they no longer wish to be ruled by notoriously venal people in Washington, irrevocably caught up in this outmoded, long discredited, and arms industry funded neoconservative ideology of unipolar global hegemony. And yes, that is what this coming war with China is about, world domination by Washington. The same Democrats and Republicans whose hands are still covered in blood just in our lifetimes from Ukraine, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Palestine, Yemen, Somalia, and Afghanistan now want to go to war with China. But just like the other wars you've likely lived through, it's not our war, it's their war, even if the American people are fighting it. We must stop this madness. Americans can no longer ignore the facts that it is our government, the world empire, with some 800 bases in 70 countries around the world that began these new cold wars with Russia and China. We were supposed to have a peace dividend. Washington remains the aggressor. The U.S. empire is the single greatest threat to peace and global stability. After all, it was Washington that unilaterally withdrew from such 20th century arms control pillars as the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and the Open Skies Treaty. These jingoistic moves triggered the nuclear arms race in the 21st century with no end in sight. The U.S. government has still not been held responsible for its recent atrocities, including George W. Bush's torture program, the devastating 20-year Afghanistan war, the Iraq war, and the genocide that the U.S. helped commit in Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The highest levels, Washington has even committed outright treason against the American people, taking the side of al-Qaeda and its affiliates, notably in the wars in Libya, Syria, and Yemen. Hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered in these conflicts alone. We have no moral authority left. We are spending well over $1 trillion on this empire every year. Does this kind of imperial fanaticism make us proud to be Americans? Is this what makes America great? I don't think so. In fact, as Ron Paul once wrote, How much longer can we afford this unnecessary and counterproductive extravagance? While our government engages in deficit spending to fund its military exploits overseas, detracting from our own productivity, countries like China are filling the void by expanding their trade opportunities. I have never understood this talk of our military presence as a so-called strategic reserve of Western civilization. Instead, the best indication of our civilization has been our prestige in international trade. We should let the best measure of our American greatness come from free and peaceful trade with other nations, not from displays of our military might. Now this year, Brown University's Cost of War Project published an updated study, which gives a conservative estimate, that's their words, that direct and indirect deaths in post-9/11 war zones totaled roughly 4.5 million people. As Martin Luther King Jr. said during the Vietnam War, in which successive U.S. regimes butchered millions, it is this government that is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. There is no reason for war or brinksmanship with China, nor this mammoth buildup. Great power competition with Russia and China is a project of the neoconservatives and their analogs in the liberal imperialist centrist faction. The Hawks are ideologically bent on global primacy and full-spectrum dominance. Their chosen brand of competition serves doubly as a gargantuan public works project, which is impoverishing us, just these make-work projects for the military, particularly the Air Force and the Navy, and of course the Marines and the Army are eager to get in on it now as well. It's a multi-trillion dollar corporate welfare scheme for the military-industrial complex. However, America's falling apart. Our culture is in steep decline. We're broke. We're over $30 trillion in debt. This competition is at our direct expense. It will undoubtedly further impoverish and imperil the safety of the American people. And our last vestiges of our once cherished liberty will surely be eviscerated during this war. Now, to avoid the coming calamity, Americans, and especially libertarians of all stripes, can no longer afford to sit on the sidelines while their corrupt ruling class recklessly drives us toward nuclear war with Beijing and Moscow. At a minimum, we must properly regain control of our foreign policy and, in the spirit of the Ron Paul Revolution, unceasingly pursue diplomacy, free trade, free travel, and cultural exchange. We could still choose peace. Now, I want to talk about something I call the next Giuliani moment. We need to be able to communicate with Republicans and conservatives effectively without pandering to their paranoia when it comes to China. It is well known that the Democrats love war. As if the Barack Obama years left any doubt, this can be seen with utter clarity, given the bloody anti-Russia proxy war in Ukraine and the Democratic Party's unanimous support. The party champions the war regardless of the myriad human, economic, financial, moral, and environmental costs. Indeed, Biden's Russia policy has consisted of seeking further NATO expansion, leading some of the alliance's largest war drills since the Cold War era in Eastern Europe, simulating nuclear first strikes with bombers a dozen miles off of Russia's borders, and maintaining a U.S. naval presence in the Black Sea for 182 days during 2021. Imagine if the shoe was on the other foot. During the lead up to the invasion, Biden's administration continued increasing military support to Ukraine while Kiev waged a war against its own people in the Donbass. Biden proceeded making Ukraine a de facto NATO state, deliberately crossing the Russians' brightest of all red lines and provoking the current war, eyeing this future war with China as well. Take Russia down first. And since the invasion, the White House's policy has included blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines, according to reporting from Seymour Hersh, making calls for regime change, sabotaging peace talks again and again and again, ratcheting nuclear tensions higher than the Cuban Missile Crisis, providing long-range artillery rocket systems to be used against Crimea, and waging an unprecedented economic war in spite of substantial blowback to the American people. They're attempting omnicide, fighting Vladimir Putin to the last Ukrainian in order to weaken Moscow. Is this what Russiagate deluded voters bought with the slogan, America's back? It should have been obvious when Biden ran that he represented precisely the same factions that set the stage for the current brinksmanship with Russia and China during the Clinton, Bush II, Obama, and Trump eras. Since Bill Clinton expanded NATO in the late 90s, breaking America's promises never to expand the alliance one inch eastward beyond Germany and launch the illegal war in Kosovo, these Cold War 2.0 policies have only been allowed to become more hawkish, never moderated. The neocons declared their current doctrine in the Pentagon's 1992 defense planning guidance. They want nothing less than world domination. He said, Paul Wolfowitz and Zalmay Khalilzad were tasked by Dick Cheney when he's Secretary of Defense to write this up, a policy for the 21st century and the post-Cold War era. And since America, they figured, was the lone superpower in the world, our job was to ensure that no rivals ever develop in the future. So no single country or even conceivable regional alliance of countries will ever be able to challenge American military power. And this meant expanding security guarantees to former Warsaw Pact states, NATO expansion, and expanding our alliances in Latin America, in the Middle East, and in Asia. And this would require exponentially more spending on American air and naval power, as well as on missile defense. This is entirely a corporate welfare scheme backed by people who are ideologically bent on taking over the planet. So we cannot support any part of this, including repressing militarily China's rise. There are many issues facing the American people, but none more important than this. Our entire species is at stake. Libertarians will be tempted to make alliances with people on the right who support these China policies. Some libertarian thought leaders argue that it's a necessary measure to collectively oppose some of our shared domestic enemies. But as you can see, our shared domestic enemies, the leaders of the Democratic Party, are the ones taking us to war with China. So we're not going to cheerlead their policy and pretend we hate them at the same time. Now, the issue with this calculation should be self-evident, and hence why it's not argued that we should ally with left-wingers or indeed self-styled libertarians who are obsessed with taking on Russia for any other reason. We cannot tolerate nor assist a neoconservative populist rebrand attempt, and we can see this coming with various candidates and lawmakers on the MAGA right. The fact is, Obama launched the Asia pivot. The pivot was led by key architect Kirk Campbell, who is now, as I said, Biden's top Asia official on the NSC, and he's a former CEO and co-founder of the Center for a New American Security, which is a big bank and arms-funded think tank. CNAS is funded by the State Department and the Pentagon as well, and has taken more money from weapons companies over the last several years than any other think tank in Washington. It's also funded by Google, Facebook, Exxon, Microsoft, the Japanese embassy, and Taiwan's de facto embassy here in the United States. In May, CNAS actually simulated war with China on Meet the Press, and earlier this year, they simulated an invasion of Taiwan with the new House panel on China. This is unprecedented. Some neoconservative, hawkish think tank simulating war with China with members of Congress. And of course, the conclusion of Representative Mike Gallagher, the Republican, was that thus, we must arm Taiwan to the teeth. But even in their own study, even in their own simulation, they found that the U.S. would suffer egregious losses, and the world markets would be left in absolute shambles. And the solution is to just continue down the current path, but harder. CNAS CEOs, co-founders, and associates proliferate throughout Biden's foreign policy team. The Pentagon reaffirmed again that China is our main target. The GOP and many new right figures in and out of government are singing and dancing to songs picked by the military-industrial complex and the Democrats. You can observe Nancy Pelosi's brinksmanship to see the Democrats. They still own this coming war with China. Republicans are the junior partners, and they've been trying to catch up, frantically dancing for Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Raytheon, who all fund CNAS, by the way. And we should convince potential conservative recruits to change the music, choose non-intervention, and peace. We should follow Ron Paul's example. In 2007, during the famous Giuliani moment, Paul was booed by Republicans who were reluctant to accept that they had been lied to by the W. Bush government and the corporate press about our murderous foreign policy in the Middle East. He said the 9/11 attacks were blowback from a fight that Clinton helped pick by sanctioning and ceaselessly bombing Iraq for 8 years from U.S. military bases peppered throughout the Arabian Peninsula. He explained that these bases were located on territory which Saudi and Egyptian al-Qaeda members considered their holy land. And as a result, he said, our nation paid a price. He asked, are we prepared to persist with this hyper-interventionist foreign policy, knowing the unnecessary risks? How would we feel if somebody else did this to us? Of course, hundreds of thousands of people were dying in Iraq, and this was also about our support for the Israeli apartheid state in Palestine. Of course, none of these policies really ever changed. We still occupy Iraq and Syria. We're trying to get the war in Yemen started again, at least the Biden administration is, sanctioning Syria into the ground and starving their people to death and bombing their country. And Paul knew he was neither making friends at Fox News nor on that stage, but he told the truth anyway. He changed the world by changing people's minds. Had he pulled his punches when it came to foreign policy, many of us would not be fighting for peace, prosperity, and liberty today. We also know how quickly America's Cold Wars can heat up now, so the time for a no Cold War with Russia and China is right now. So here's to the next Giuliani moment. Thank you.